Expanded jobless benefits help many Americans get through the pandemic.
But starting today, hundreds of thousands will not get those extra checks. Scott Horsley brings us that. I'm Scott Detrow.
I'm Scott Simon. We overflow with Scotts on Up First from NPR News.
Republican governors say the $300 supplement is stopping people from applying for jobs.
For our economy to fully recover, we have to get our people back to work.
We've got the details on who's affected.
President Biden's on his first trip overseas, and coming up, he meets with America's most important allies.
And we'll hear about a pledge Biden made to send hundreds of millions of COVID vaccines abroad. Will they actually get into people's arms?
Please stay with us. We've got the news you need to start your weekend.
This message comes from NPR sponsor TalkDesk. TalkDesk offers a better way to do customer experience. With TalkDesk's innovative solution, you can get superior contact centers up and running fast. So if you're customer obsessed, visit TalkDesk.com.
The following message comes from NPR sponsor WeWork. Escape the distractions of working from home with WeWork All Access. One monthly membership gives you access to hundreds of convenient workspaces nationwide. Sign up today to get a free trial for new members at WeWork.com/NPR. Terms apply.
Today, several hundred thousand people in four states are losing their expanded unemployment benefits.
Millions more will see their payments cut off in the weeks to come as 25 states end the special pandemic jobless benefits ahead of schedule.
Republican governors in those states argued that the extra money the federal government has been offering makes it hard for employers to find workers they need. NPR chief economic correspondent Scott Horsley joins us now. Scott, thanks so much for being with us.
Good morning.
Which states are cutting benefits and why?
Mississippi, Missouri, Iowa, and Alaska are the first states to cut benefits as of this weekend. 21 other states are going to follow in the coming weeks. The Republican governors in all those states say the extra $300 a week that the federal government's been paying during the pandemic is discouraging people from taking jobs that are available. Here's Mississippi Governor Tate Reeves.
For our economy to fully recover, we have to get our people back to work. And we think that the pandemic, for all intents and purposes, is behind us.
Mississippi, by the way, ranks last in the country in COVID vaccinations. The state's unemployment rate is also higher than the national average, but Governor Reeves' state is at the front of the pack when it comes to cutting off benefits starting today.
What are the indications and information? Have the enhanced benefits truly kept people from looking for work?
You know, economists are divided on that question. I've been asking people who've been getting the payments, like Nicole Jones in Jackson, Mississippi. She says there are a lot of different factors keeping people out of work. One is health concerns. She, for example, has not been vaccinated yet. Child care is also an issue for a lot of parents, especially if they have kids who are not in school. But money is part of the equation. Before the pandemic, Jones worked a lot of different jobs in customer service and at Head Start and as a nursing assistant. What they all had in common was pretty low wages.
The job market here, they really do not pay enough, just paycheck to paycheck.
An extra $300 a week in unemployment benefits, that is the equivalent of $7.50 an hour for a full-time worker. So where those benefits are available, they might make low-wage jobs less attractive. Employers might have to pay it more in order to find workers. By doing away with the benefits early, the Republican governors are taking some of that pressure off employers.
And what's happening in states that are not ending benefits early?
The other 25 states are going to keep paying an extra $300 a week, but only through the beginning of September. After that, the benefits phase out across the country. So we've basically got a three-month experiment here, with half the states ending benefits early, half keeping them in place through the summer. And then at some point, we will be able to see, did the states that cut off benefits early actually put more people back to work more quickly?
What will this mean for people losing benefits and for their families?
Obviously, it's going to be a hardship for some. They are losing money that might have been helping to pay the rent or to buy groceries. In some instances, they might be forced into taking a job they don't feel comfortable at and possibly missing out on a job that would be a better fit down the road. To be sure, some people might find jobs right now that are going to be very satisfying. But Elise Gould, who's with the left-leaning Economic Policy Institute, says she doubts this experiment is actually going to result in a lot more people going back to work more quickly than they otherwise would.
Those workers and their families are all of a sudden going to lose a vital lifeline without really having any safety net behind them. I think it'll be interesting to see what happens in terms of filling jobs in those states versus the states that have continued to provide that support to workers and their families. And I would be very surprised if we see much difference.
Cutting off benefits early also means billions of dollars in federal aid is not going to be flowing to those 25 states. Unless that money is replaced in the economy by wages, it could mean a lot less spending power and a blow to the local economies.
NPR Chief Economic Correspondent Scott Horsley, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
To Southwest England now, where President Biden is meeting in person with other leaders at the G7. Along with the U.S., the summit includes the U.K., Canada, France, Germany, Italy, and Japan.
Today, they'll talk about China and how to respond to its rising power. NPR White House correspondent Franco Ordonez is in Cornwall. Franco, thanks so much for being with us.
Hey, Scott.
What kind of response are the leaders planning?
Well, you know, they're talking about a new fund. It's going to be a counterpoint to what's known as the Belt and Road Initiative from China. Belt and Road is what China has used to help build big projects around the world. And officials from Latin America, for example, have told me that it's politically helpful to them. You know, this cash helps them build roads and create some jobs. And that really matters when it comes time for them to be up for re-election. But the program has been criticized because the funding tends to come with conditions down the road and poor environmental and labor standards. White House officials told us that the G7 wants to help fill a gap there. And the World Bank says there's about $40 billion of projects needed in the developing world through 2035. So there's a lot of need.
President Biden has talked an awful lot about how he sees the huge strategic challenge of China. Are European leaders in agreement with him?
Well, this has been a point of divergence. There are concerns about China, but we've seen on issues like 5G mobile internet that the United Kingdom was willing to go its own way and, frankly, work with Chinese suppliers that the United States refused. I talked about this split with Andrea Kendall Taylor. She advised the Biden transition team before he took office. She says there have been some shifts. For example, Lithuania pulled out of an infrastructure group with China, and the EU has issued sanctions on China.
So all of those things signal how the ground is really moving in Europe, that there is more consensus about the threat of the challenge that China poses.
Franco, what tangible signs are you looking for to see whether President Biden can persuade his U.S. allies to form a more united front?
Well, the White House says that Biden tomorrow is going to push G7 leaders to take a tougher stand against China's use of forced labor. And as you've talked about on this show, there are people, the Uyghur ethnic minority, who are forced to produce cotton and work in factories that make products that end up in big brands bought in G7 nations. So we'll see whether this becomes part of the joint statement that leaders agree to during the summit. And we'll see that statement sometime tomorrow.
And after the wrap-up, a big meeting in Geneva, right?
Yeah, the big event that everyone's watching for next week is the meeting in Geneva with Russian President Vladimir Putin. But before that, he's going to go to Brussels, and he wants to talk about China there, too, with NATO and European leaders. Biden has really been trying to cast this trip as a chance for democracies like the U.S. and in Europe to show that they're a better model than autocracies in Russia and China. And I expect he'll talk more about that in a press conference he's expected to have here.
Franco, what's it like to be surrounded by all these Scots?
You know, it's always an honor to be on with the Scots of NPR.
Franco Ordonez is traveling with the president in Cornwall. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And you can hear from Franco and other NPR political correspondents, including this Scott right here, on the NPR Politics podcast. You can download, subscribe, and let us know how you like it. Just before Biden's big trip to Europe,
America will be the arsenal of vaccines in our fight against global COVID-19.
The president announced that America will donate $500 million vaccines to the COVAX program. That's the project aimed at people in lower-income countries around the world.
As vaccination rates in the U.S. and parts of Europe push well above 50%, some African nations haven't vaccinated anyone at all. Less than 1% of the continent is fully immunized against COVID.
Africa is where we now find NPR's Jason Beaubien. He joins us from Freetown, Sierra Leone. Hey, Jason.
Hey, good morning.
So what has the reaction there been to this announcement?
You know, it's really complicated. Government officials and public health people, they certainly welcome this. But this announcement
doesn't solve their vaccine problem right away for a number of reasons. And then among ordinary folks and the local media, this hasn't really attracted much attention at all.
And is that because Sierra Leone actually is doing okay on the infection rate front?
Yeah, that's exactly right, Scott. COVID numbers here in Sierra Leone are incredibly low. Reported cases many days are in the single digits for this country of 8 million people. And COVID really isn't viewed as a crisis. Many people seem to think that it's not a threat despite public health officials warning otherwise. And Sierra Leoneans, for the most part, you know, they aren't wearing masks out on the street. Taxis and buses, you see them just completely packed. Life has very much gone back to normal. You know, this is a very poor country and people have other things to worry about.
What are government officials saying, though?
Well, their response, you know, has been muted in part because it's not entirely clear which countries are going to get these doses. But let's be really clear. This is significant. This is a lot of doses. But the first batch isn't going to get here until August. The majority of the 500 million doses won't be delivered until next year. So it doesn't solve the short-term problem of so many people remaining vulnerable to COVID infections. And finally, there's the issue that this is the Pfizer vaccine he's offering, which many African nations are not currently in a position to handle because it needs special ultra-cold storage.
Well, I'm just dwelling on next year. You're in Sierra Leone. Do they have that cold storage, those special freezers there?
So Sierra Leone actually does have one of these super cold freezers, which is better than a lot of other countries on the continent. And that's because Sierra Leone has been using a new Ebola vaccine this year. And that vaccine also requires this minus 70 degrees Celsius storage.
And can you help me do the Fahrenheit conversion on that?
Yeah, it's like negative 94 or something like that Fahrenheit. This freezer, it's also only one. It's like a large domestic stand-up freezer. Safa Kamara, he's an immunization officer with UNICEF here in Freetown. I was talking with him. He helps to set up vaccination drives for other things across the country. And he says Sierra Leone simply is not ready right now to do a COVID campaign with Pfizer.
It will be difficult, though the country may want to receive the Pfizer vaccines, but it will be difficult except if we can get the ultra cold chain system in place.
You know, and it's not just Sierra Leone. There are many countries across Africa that are going to need new equipment to be able to handle this particular vaccine. You know, even Moderna, which is another mRNA vaccine, would have been easier. It needs to be kept at about minus 20 centigrade. That's about negative 4 Fahrenheit. And Sierra Leone has more freezers capable of handling that. So yes, this is a really significant announcement of a half a billion doses. The rest of the G7 is pledging donations that'll bring it up to a full 1 billion shots in total. But there's still a lot of challenges, particularly for some of the poorest countries, before they're going to be able to actually make use of those doses.
NPR correspondent Jason Beaubien in Freetown, Sierra Leone. Jason, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
And that's Up First for Saturday, June 12, 2021. I'm Scott Simon.
I'm Scott Detrow, and we have a favor to ask you. Please help us make this podcast even better.
Just go to npr.org/podcast survey, and in a few minutes, you can tell us what you like and what you don't.
We would love to hear from you, whether you wake up to Up First every morning or whether this is your first time listening. Again, that website is npr.org/podcast survey.
And Up First returns Monday with news to start your week. You can follow us on social media. We are at Up First on Twitter.
And for more news and interviews, books and music, you can find us on the radio.
Weekend edition, Saturday and Sunday mornings. Find your NPR station at stations.npr.org.
On NPR's Rough Translation, a civilian and a soldier looking for love.
I tried to use some of my best lines on Alicia. I told her I'd die for her.
She said, "I'll die for you." It's like, you're a soldier. You'll die for anyone.
Stories about connection and missed connections. Each week on Homefront, the new season from Rough Translation.